The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan. Tonight's show is going to be especially interesting because it involves something that on the surface doesn't make a lot of sense. Psychotherapy with brain-injured people. Psychotherapy with people whose minds have been compromised by harm to the brain of one kind or another. Now, when I was a young therapist, I might have thought, well, what can you do under those circumstances? But I now realize with great clarity that, in fact, an injured person, whether it's emotional or physical, an individual whose emotional, intellectual capacity, for whatever reason, is carrying a burden, does best with an emotionally supportive, caring, or as I would say, empathic therapy. My guest today is Richard Gottlieb, Dick Gottlieb. He's a social worker from Michigan, and he works, among other things, with individuals who are being rehabilitated for brain injury and head injury. I'll let him tell you more about that in a couple of minutes. I think this is a very important area. In fact, it's so important to me that in my guidelines for empathic therapy that I worked out with a dozen of our advisory council members from our Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, Education, and Living, in those guidelines, we specifically say that all people, including those suffering from brain injury, harm to their brain, will do best when they're given an empathic, caring, informed, engaging psychotherapy or counseling, as well as an empathic environment. Empathic therapy, those therapies that begin with centering on the individual and the individual's needs in a treasuring and caring manner, are in fact the best approach to all people who are struggling with the control, management, development of their emotions and their intellect. Well, one thing that Dick Gottlieb and I have in common is an individual who's a hero of ours, Bert Caron, who has for decades been clinical professor of psychology at Michigan State. Bert has been a mentor to Dick Gottlieb and a friend to me, and to some extent a mentor as we are peers. Years ago, when I first took on psychiatric reform and beginning with the standing up to the lobotomists and turning back a new wave of lobotomy, Bert, our mutual friend, was one of the few high-ranking, respected academics who stuck out his neck courageously to support what I was doing. And at our annual conference, our empathic therapy conference, April 8th through 10th, we'll be giving the first empathic therapy award to Bert. To Bertrand Caron. Now, one of the things that Bert did that was so stunning was that he developed the idea that the best therapy for people labeled schizophrenic was not drugs or shock treatment or incarceration, but psychotherapy. And he wrote a book, The Psychotherapy of Schizophrenia. And he called it the first, the best, the primary approach to helping people. And this sort of rounds out my introduction, which is that what human beings need, whether they're struggling with everyday living, whether they're actually struggling with psychosis, or whether they're brain injured, is in fact, if they're going to get therapy, an empathic counseling that begins with really caring about them, understanding their viewpoint, not bringing in bizarre psychiatric diagnoses or toxic psychiatric drugs, but bringing in engaging human relationship. And Bert was good at that, whether he's sitting at a table taking a break at one of our conferences or whether he's speaking at one of our conferences. Now, Bert's recovering from an auto accident, and he'll be at home, but we're going to tape him in his acceptance of the Empathic Therapy Award. And there's still time for y'all to sign up for the Empathic Therapy Conference. Just go to empathictherapy.org. And I've enlisted Dick, and I hope he's going to be able to do it since he knows Bert, to film Bert for us. He can tell me on the air how's that going. He may not have been able to get in touch with Bert as of yet. So I'm introducing you to Richard Dick Gottlieb. And Dick, are you there?
I am.
Oh, and you sound good.
Thank you.
Have you been able to get in touch with Bert yet?
Yes, I did. I talked with him today. And it is all arranged for Saturday taping. And he said he is going to dress up and try to look good.
Well, excellent. And he's welcome to talk to us at the conference about anything he wishes. Our relationship with me, with you, with members of the group, his acceptance of the award, and, of course, his own life's work. Now, Dick, you're a social worker,
mm-hmm.
and you're a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
What town do you work out of? I didn't have that information.
My private practice is in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
All right. And Grand Rapids is how far from the University of how far from Michigan State?
It's about 60 miles.
Okay, but you've managed to drive in to take courses with Bert and to get to know him.
Yes, yes. I went. I attended a seminar he held several years ago in his home office, where a group of therapists met once a week to discuss ideas and theory and patients and patient treatment. And we met for, I think it was 2 hours in the evening on a Monday for 15 weeks. And it was a marvelous experience. It was invaluable.
Well, let's jump right in and talk to us, and this is going to be new for me. I purposely didn't interview you about this.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me and to our audience about how you got involved with working with the rehabilitation of people with, I assume, brain and head injury.
Yes. Well, I'd been in private practice for decades, and at some point about 2.5 years ago, I needed to supplement my income. I am not a very good businessman. I charged patients what they could afford. And as the economy deteriorated, I had to seek supplemental income. So a friend of mine told me about a job possibility in Holland, Michigan, which is about 40 miles from here. And it involved rehabilitation, which I had never worked in, but it was to treat patients, so it seemed like a viable thing. And I started in August of 2008 and started seeing patients who were in outpatient rehabilitation for a variety of difficulties. I worked primarily for a neuro rehab unit. So most of the patients I saw were people who had TBIs, traumatic brain injuries, or had had brain surgery or brain cancer and then surgery. And I also took over a support group that had been running there for many years and started meeting once a month with people who just were seeking a group for support to sit with like-minded people and converse.
And I group of these were professionals or these were patients?
No, these were patients and
patient support
and their caregivers.
So, and yes, who have a lot of stress.
Mm-hmm.
Now, any of these military, a lot of traumatic brain injury, are those all civilians?
No, these were all civilians.
Mm-hmm. Did you begin to discover? What surprised you?
Well, I knew I would be exercising muscles that I had never exercised before because being a psychotherapist, I relied pretty heavily, except working with children, I relied on the spoken word. And many of these people had difficulty speaking. But as I started working with them, I discovered it was the same issues as working with anyone else. I had to listen intently. I had to respond therapeutically. It just took longer. So in an hour-long session, we might have three or four ideas that would get promulgated by the patient and I could respond to. And I started to see rather quickly, really after one or two sessions, I was getting brighter eyes and more engaging conversation and more openness. And people started reporting that they felt different talking to me than they had felt talking to other people who had been counseling them or providing therapy. Many of these people had a long history after their injury of getting medications from psychiatrists, and were surprised to learn that they actually could engage with someone without having to be medicated to do so.
Now, how did it come about that they could discover that they didn't need the medication? How come they got off of them or reduced them?
Well, they discovered that their brain activity increased after talking. The experience of having someone looking at you, waiting for speech production, or sometimes for nonverbal production, gave the patients a sense of being respected, which sometimes was a very rare experience for them, especially from professionals. They experienced mostly support at home, but in going out into the professional world, for example, they would go into an appointment with a psychiatrist or a psychologist or a social worker and would be encouraged to hurry up or encouraged or their words would be filled in by the therapist. And I didn't do that. I waited. And people started feeling at ease with themselves, at ease in conversation with me. And the first sign of that, again, was this sort of a brightening of affect, facially. And then jokes started to be told, and some lightness entered the relationship. And it seemed to be, and it's what happened after one or two sessions, it seemed to be a response to just being regarded.
Well, this is very profound, and it reminds me of my experience dealing with young people who are hallucinating and,
yes,
and are very, very disturbed.
Absolutely.
And if you take your time and you listen, again, you get very rapid responses from exactly the people that the establishment tells us we can't talk to.
Right. Exactly.
You've had that experience too, it sounds like.
Oh, very much. And it is very similar to talking with someone who is suffering from a psychosis. The the sense that there is no meaning in what they're saying is wrong. There is meaning. You just have to work harder to find it, because they're working so hard to produce it. But the meaning is there, and it's a delicate dance. I once wrote a line describing therapy as an expert teaching a novice how to dance, and the expert is the patient, and the novice is the therapist. And that's how I experience this, that they are teaching me how they think, they're teaching me where the difficulties are, and I am responding. I get it. And that sense in the patient that here's someone who, for no reason at all, gets it, gives them a profound sense of not being alone in their experience.
I love what you're saying. You're listening to Dick Gottlieb, therapist, social worker. I love what you're saying. You're really cutting to the heart of a lot of what the common elements of empathic therapy are about.
Mm-hmm.
Now, have some of these people actually had their medications reduced? And if so, how did that come about?
Well, yes. They would show up at their psychiatrist's office or their general physician's office and be in better shape and would be asked, why, well, you're looking good, what's going on? And they would say, well, we're talking with this social worker over at the Holland Hospital, and I'm feeling better. And so the physician would talk about start reducing the need for controlling medications, which then would amplify the changes. I mean, once the medications would start to be reduced, then the degree of engagement would increase, and the concomitant growth in the relationship and effect of the relationship. So it becomes a spiral up rather than a spiral down.
One of the points that I like to make is that the more a person actually might have something wrong with their brain, the worse psychiatric drugs are going to hit them. So if you actually think you have a biochemical imbalance, and the odds on that are extraordinarily small unless you have the unbalance given to you by psychiatric drugs or an actual disorder like Cushing's or hypothyroidism. But when people say, well, you know, what about people with the imbalances or brain injury, where they're the least people who can handle the added toxicity, the added impairment of drugs. So with the people you're working with, you're going to see even a more dramatic improvement,
yes,
I would think, as the meds are cut back, because they really need whatever brain power they got to be free of the drugs.
Exactly. And what the patients are doing who have either traumatic brain injury or surgical injury, injury caused by surgery, most commonly for cancer, brain cancer, is that they have chunks of their brain either dead or removed, and the brain's capacity, the term that is current is plasticity, the brain's capacity to compensate and, newly discovered, to grow new neurons has been underestimated, in fact denied for years and years, but its capacity to do so and to compensate for the damage or the injury is unexplored. And what I'm finding is people are compensating. I have a patient who, when I first met him, he was uncommunicative except for explosive outbursts, at which point he would repeat screaming the same lines, and they would be very intense, either hateful lines or self-deprecating lines that he would scream. So when he saw me not back away from that, but sort of talk with him with a heightened voice myself and engage with him about what he was saying, and then he started to explore, what it means to say, I hate, I hate, I hate, I hate. And I would respond back, what do you hate? What do you hate? What do you hate? And I would repeat as he did. His eyes would blink open, and he would say, I don't know. And I say, well, let's talk about it. Let's find out what you hate. And he had never gone past that point. And the explosive verbalizations decreased. And he started to examine all of these very intense feelings he was experiencing inside. Well, now after 2 years, we have long conversations. He is engaged. He almost never has his explosiveness. It's now down to once every 6 months. And when he does, he can then recover from it and describe what is going on for him. And this is someone who had been given up for dead after his he had brain cancer and surgery, and he wasn't expected to live. And here he is living, and he's cancer free, and he's getting better.
That's a marvelous story. Is he on any psychiatric drugs at all?
No.
Was he when you first started to work with him?
Yep.
What a great story. I hope that that you'll write some of this up. This would make a wonderful material just to start for the free newsletter that we give out at empathictherapy.org. It would be really good to have you work up. Have you written about this at all, Dick?
No. Over the years, I have tried writing and then find that I just go back to wanting to do work with people, and I sit with a blank page often and don't produce much.
Well, some folks like to do that and some don't, but certainly it would be an honor if you would try to work up some of these thoughts for the Empathic Therapy newsletter. What you're saying is very profound and very, very important. Tell us more. Do you have another patient in particular who comes to mind?
Well, I had I took the support group that I work with now once a month. I took them on an outing the other day. This is something I learned when I used to work with autistic children in a day treatment program, that the therapy needs to be in a larger context and informed by broader experience. So I arranged to take the entire support group, we had 31 people, on a bus to go to a semi-pro hockey game. And, you know, people in wheelchairs and people who walk slowly and people, but they felt safe because it was a group. It was a group of people they knew, and they were out in the community. And at the end of the night, one young woman called me over, and in halting speech because of her damage, she said to me, she thanked me for arranging this, and she said, this makes me feel like a person.
That's beautiful. That's really, really beautiful. It'll be interesting. We're going to take a break in about 5 or 6 minutes.
Okay.
I think it'll be interesting when we come back from the break, perhaps to talk also about autism. And,
oh, yes.
Because I think we'll find, right, the same principles apply.
Absolutely.
How many people did you have helping you with this 30-31 size group?
I had one young woman who is a part-time employee and has been sitting in on the group for many months, very bright. She's studying physical therapy, but she really could do just about anything. And she helped me with sort of keeping an eye on people and engaging when there were problems. And so I had one
just
of the
two of you.
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing. That's just absolutely astonishing. It's a testimonial to everything I believe about what happens when the people we're serving trust us.
Yeah.
They behave to the standard that they know we need.
Absolutely.
They behave better.
Absolutely. There was not a problem. I mean, we had not only the patients, but spouses of the patients, and we had one patient who brought grandchildren, and one patient, in fact, two patients who brought grandchildren. And and children and married children. I mean, we had families represented, and the group self-governs. It is not something that has to be controlled or dominated. If they have a problem, they call me over, and we had one person who did have a problem, and so we had a 15-minute session in the middle of the hockey game.
And it went this is such an important principle about the role of family in helping people who might otherwise be out of control. I mean, it's been pointed out that the school assemblies, which nowadays are completely out of control too often, that just a few parents scattered in the audiences on a regular day will calm down the group.
Right.
Relationship, not drugs, relationship.
Yeah, and I think that that's the center of it. I mean, the example you give of the assembly, parents being there suggests the parents care about the students, even students who are not their children. And the message when the assembly is out of control is that they don't feel cared about by the school personnel.
That's right. That's right. That's a very hard lesson to get. I mean, I was slow in realizing that when you discipline children and provide them moral authority, that as much as they may gripe about it, it's absolutely what they need and absolutely what's what creates respectful relationships with them.
Yeah.
This is very interesting today in terms of the universality of these really basic principles you're getting down to. I love the slowing down and listening, slowing down and listening, getting in touch with how the other person is communicating so that you can communicate with them.
In a manner that's
meaningful and soothing and calming to them.
Exactly.
Other thoughts before we close out? First, just for the half hour. First, how can people get in touch with you? You have a private practice.
Mm-hmm.
How do they get in touch with you?
They could call me. I have an office phone number.
You can give that out.
Okay. It's 616-774-9000.
And that's for your private
mm-hmm.
practice?
Mm-hmm.
And it's 616-774-1000.
No, 9000.
9000.
9000.
Okay. 616-774-9000 to get in touch in Michigan with Dick Gottlieb. Your experience reminds me also of when I was a college student running a state mental hospital volunteer. Literally, I was a freshman, sophomore in mm-hmm. college. And eventually we sort of purloined the keys to the hospital, and people got used to our having them. And I remember one day two of us took the women's violent ward, the whole ward, out of the hospital and into town for the day
mm-hmm.
and brought them back without incident. Without incident.
That's right.
Because they were responding to the trust we gave them and their desire to not betray that trust and get us in any trouble.
My sense is that people fear patients not because the patients are dangerous, but because the patients are afraid themselves, and that the therapist, the worker, the aide, experiences that fear that is in the patient, and then they make the mistake of thinking it's their own. And I can, after the break, I guess I could give you an example of that.
It's induced fear. It's what I would call an induced emotion, an induced fear from the other person. This is Dr. Peter Breggin interviewing Dick Gottlieb.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
This is Dr. Meir Eisenstein. Every Thursday morning, 10 a.m. Eastern Time, I will be coming to you live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I will bring my background as a physician and as an attorney to help you with a minimal pharmaceutical and a minimal surgical approach to your medical issues. Please come join me.
So to join in on the conversation, call 888-874-4888. Ask Dr. Eisenstein, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, only on Progressive Radio Network.
Incisive analysis on the state of our planet from a black left perspective, join me, Glenn Ford, and my colleague, Nellie Bailey, at Black Agenda Radio, right here on the Progressive Radio Network. We bring you the full scope of reality as we and our interlocutors see it every Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Black Agenda Radio, the place to get oriented to the black left worldview on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Barry Farber with the best self-improvement advice you've ever had or ever heard. Learn a foreign language. Sounds impossible? Give me a chance to prove it. I'm Barry Farber. I can guide you to mastery of any language in the world quickly, easily, inexpensively, and at home. You will grow culturally, linguistically, intellectually, commercially, professionally, even romantically. Get that smile off. Face it, happened to me. Listen to the Barry Farber Language Club for details. Wednesday mornings right here on the Progressive Radio Network. Every Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. beginning March 23rd.
This is Adam Coulter with Brooklyn Jazz Underground Radio. We'll be here every Tuesday from 5 to 6 with great music, interviews, and live performances. Right here on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network. Again, that's Tuesdays from 5 to 6, or you can listen anytime at the archive at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Hey, Lee.
Yeah, Jeff.
Your girlfriend gave another interview.
No, don't play it.
Listen to this.
I have a journalism degree. That is what I studied. I understand that this cornerstone of our democracy is a free press.
Shut it off. I said not to play it.
We are in the worst reality show in history.
Why won't she shut up?
You know she's going to be president, right?
Okay, stop it. That's not funny.
I think we should just go limp. Lay back. Maybe then the mama grizzly won't tear off your limbs.
Cheater in the Rude, Thursdays, 8 p.m., Progressive Radio Network.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
My guest today, whom you've been listening to, is Richard Gottlieb from Michigan. And we're having this really interesting conversation about the common aspects of a helping relationship, whether it's for somebody who's brain injured, somebody who's very, very disturbed, or really for any of us. Dick, I want to give you the opportunity to begin with anything you like, or to go ahead and let's talk some about your experience with working with children and adults labeled autistic.
First clinical job after graduating undergraduate school. I had worked as a graduate student, as an undergraduate student, as you had, in a psychiatric hospital, which was wonderful. At that time, this was in the 60s, the psychiatric hospitals were already being closed down. The term was deinstitutionalization. So it was the last opportunity I had of working in a large state mental hospital, but it was very helpful, and there were some really good psychiatrists who did psychotherapy at the time, which is a rare thing now. And I learned much, but after I graduated, I got a job working in a program for autistic children that was a day treatment or a partial hospitalization program. It was 6 hours, 5 days a week, and I was hired by one of my other mentors in life, a Dr. George Inge, who was a psychiatrist from Texas who had been trained at Menninger's, and he hired me to work with these autistic kids, and I had never done that, but I was certainly willing to learn, and what I learned from him was essentially empathic therapy. He did not use any medications. He believed that relationship usually gets us into the problems of our life, and relationship would resolve those problems. And so he had me working with a group of kids, again, 5 days a week, intensively and primarily nonverbally. We would play games. We would sit on the floor and rock for hours on end. And twice a day, with two children, I would take kids out for contact with people in the working world. So we would go to manufacturing plants and shoe repair shops and restaurants and engage with workers, people working with their hands, who would engage with the kids. And this kind of immersion in the life of the community was Dr. Inge's idea, that this would root them in a larger context. And the treatment that I grew to understand, this empathic response, seemed to hook the kids, who eschewed all relationships except if the relationship was not intrusive, if it was just available. And there's one child in particular that I remember. I had worked with him for about 6 months, and although he had never been verbal, he was 11 years old at the time, he had never been verbal. He was making changes. He was looking at people more. He was reacting to events by coming closer rather than moving away. His repetitive behaviors had diminished tremendously. The problem was that the family had either become accustomed to or needed him to be sick. So as he was getting better, they started complaining that he was more trouble. He was making himself known. He wouldn't sit in his room all day anymore. He would walk around and point at things and want to engage with people, and this was making the family uncomfortable, so they decided to take him out of the program. But the last day he was there, he was sitting on top of a slide, and it was a spring day. And we always looked at each other when we worked together, and just before he was ready to slide down, he looked at me and he said, out loud, with perfect diction, "I don't want to go." And I said, "I know." I wanted to jump up and down and scream and yell that he had verbalized, but I just said, "I know." And he came down and just sat on my lap for the rest of the day, until he was taken away by his parents.
Well, there's a couple of things that your story brings to mind, and you give beautiful clinical vignettes. One is going way back to where you started, which was back in the 60s when there were psychiatrists who were doing good therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned to do good therapy from some psychiatrists in the early 60s when I was at Harvard and at the State University of New York and Upstate Medical Center. There were good psychiatrists doing good therapy. And there simply are hardly any anymore.
Right.
Sometimes I think I know all of them in the country, all 12.
Yeah.
But then another one comes along and another one comes along. But
mm-hmm.
the New York Times article just confirms that if you want real, genuine, empathic help, the odds on you getting it from a psychiatrist are now very small, and you have to be very careful in your choice. The other thing that you just talked about, in addition to, there's so much to that you talked about, actually. Another thing you talked about was being available rather than pushing yourself on the person.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the principles, one of the guidelines of empathic therapy as we've develop them in our organization is that we don't coerce, we don't manipulate, we don't use authoritarian techniques. And the same thing is true in our personal lives. I mean, all we can do with our care and our love is offer it.
Mm-hmm.
And then someone has to accept. And if someone doesn't accept, nothing is gained, in my experience, by pushing, by abusing, by controlling. Basically, you need the opportunity to offer. The other thing that you said, just so much, it's so pithy, your remarks, is how the family finally disrupted the therapeutic relationship.
Right.
And modern psychiatry has completely ignored this because modern psychiatry wants to align with the parents, literally against the child.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill,
yes.
Which is very involved with psychiatry. In fact, I'm a member of the American Psychiatric Association. Every year they send me a letter that I should join NAMI.
Yeah.
The Psychiatric Association sends me a letter to join NAMI. They gang up rather than support their offspring. And it's just so true that since the problems that most of us face evolve partly in our childhood, our parents are key in either healing or not healing, especially when we're young and dependent. So if you have somebody who's young or dependent, either one, young or dependent, there isn't any way to fully heal them without also working with the family, because the family will get anxious, the family will get angry, the family will get resentful, confused, and frightened, and disrupt the process. And indeed, just when it's going well, they may actually pull the person out of the process. So we work under great handicaps in our field because we're not gods. We work with what we have. And at all times, it's best to, when somebody is dependent or somebody's a child, you just got to be able to work with the family.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or the effects will be fairly limited, usually. Not always, but fairly limited.
To bring it up to my work now with people in rehab, the family involvement is just as critical and requires just as much therapy and therapeutic intervention and skill as working with the patient, because if someone suffers from a significant brain injury, especially a spouse or children feel like the person has died because they're so different. Many spouses report that they are now married to someone else. When they married one person and then that person had an injury, they experience it as being married to a stranger that they don't know.
Do some people manage to see the real person inside, the soul, the being, the way you are? Do some families manage that?
With help, they can start to see the themes and the sort of the spirit of the person, but it's very difficult to do that without somebody saying, wait a minute, let's look at this. Do you see how the injured person is doing this? Does that remind you of anything that they used to do? And without that, it is just such an overwhelmingly traumatic experience for the loved one, that they too need help with the trauma. The traumatic brain injury does not just happen to the person whose brain gets injured.
It's a really, really, really good point. I'm thinking about so many of the lessons you're communicating, and it reminds me of my work with lobotomized patients, usually in the legal arena, because I've gone to court a number of times on behalf of patients who had had lobotomies. In fact, we won the only lobotomy case I ever won in court against the Cleveland Clinic for putting electrodes inside a person's head a few years ago, and just only a few years ago, burning holes in this old lady's head.
Yeah.
And when you deal with people who have had their frontal lobes burned or cut, damaged by psychiatry and neurosurgery, there is this slowness. It's as if, the way I experience it is that the person is there, because I have a deep sense that there's a human spirit, you know, spirits, that the spirit is there, the person is there, but it's just so hard for them to get through the apparatus. It comes slowly.
Precisely.
A person like myself, who's naturally somewhat impatient, I'm sort of a get-her-done guy, got to really work to slow myself down.
Yeah.
On one occasion, I was testifying in court in Philadelphia on behalf of a man who had been given, and I'm not exaggerating, three lobotomies. Three times they'd gone inside this man's head and sliced the connections to his frontal lobes. And I was describing, he's in the audience, he's sitting at the table, actually not at the table, he was in the audience, I think his mother maybe was at the table, the plaintiff's table. It was a malpractice suit. And I was describing how terrible this was, and the effects it had on him, and how he could barely talk about what he'd had for breakfast.
Right.
And he didn't show any emotions. He was very flat and withdrawn. Mm-hmm. And during the break, there was a break in my testimony, and you're not supposed to talk to anybody, especially the plaintiff, during your break.
Mm-hmm.
But I just couldn't bear it. I went up to him because he was milling about, and I was milling about during the break, and I said to him, I'm so sorry that you have to sit and listen to what I am saying about what's been done to you. I'm sure I said it must make you want to cry. And he looked at me with the same flat expression, and he said, I am crying.
Yeah.
So the person is there, and I think you deeply respect that, and I think it's one of the great spiritual, psychological, and maybe even scientific insights of this show, that the person is always there. You're on the same page with me on that?
Yes, and I can give you an example. When I worked for that same Dr. George Inge, we set up a psychiatric hospital. This was in, 1973, in Detroit. We were given a floor of a hospital to design and staff and create a psychiatric hospital for emergency and long-term treatment of children and adolescents. And one day I was in my office, and there was a knock at the door, and there were two very large policemen bringing in a very much larger 17-year-old who was in handcuffs and shackles, leg shackles. And they said, is this where we bring them? And I said, well, for a psychiatric intake? And they said, yes. I said, yep, this is it. They took off the leg irons and handcuffs and threw him into my office and closed the door behind him. And here he was. Yeah. I mean, I'm moderately tall, but this kid was about 6'5", big, broad shoulders, and had just been thrown into my office, and the door closed, and he started walking toward me, saying he was going to throw me out the damn window. And having been trained well at that point, I realized that what he was communicating to me was not so much that he was just going to throw me out the window, but that he was very frightened. because, and I knew that because I was scared down to my boots. And before I met him, I hadn't been. So I asked myself quickly as he was walking toward me what he might be scared of, and then I realized it might be that he is scared to be alone. So I said to him, well, you can throw me out the window if you wish, but if you do, you won't have anyone to talk to.
Oh, God, I love that.
And he fell back into a chair that I had in the office, weeping. And this was a kid who had murdered. He was schizophrenic. He had hurt many people. We had him in the hospital for 6 months. Never hurt a soul. He did run once, but that's a different story. And we treated him. When he left the hospital after 6 months, he no longer showed any schizophrenic symptoms. His thought disorder had cleared. He had 18 hours a day. I mean, he slept there too, but when he was awake, he had 18 hours of therapy, talk therapy. We had no constraints. We had a full staff of people who were being trained on how to listen to patients.
Yeah, you need to make clear to the people who aren't familiar with the setting that you're talking about the milieu. You're talking about the whole environment,
yeah.
Not individual talk therapy.
Right. Well, we also had that. We had group therapy. We had milieu as an empathic experience. We had. We also took these patients out into the community. But here was somebody who had for years been a terror in the community outside, and once he was in the hospital and started to be listened to, he was treated to cure.
Well, I think what you're saying is just, again, incredibly important. I love your vignettes. One of the things that I try to teach people when I give talks on therapy is that when the patient has an emergency, you don't. And that if you don't have an emergency, when the patient's having an emergency, they'll get over theirs.
Mm-hmm.
But if you react like it's an emergency, like, my God, he's going to throw me out the window, call the police, get on the phone, pick up a heavy object, you've escalated the emergency.
Exactly.
And you
I would have been out the window. There's no question about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a wonderful, wonderful story. But by the way, my audience will be surprised to learn that this is Dick Gottlieb's first ever radio show.
And I'm scared down to my boots again.
You've done beautifully. Have you gotten relaxed finally? Or
no,
I can't tell you're tense.
They're still up to my ears. My wife, Marianne, knows exactly what I mean. She's listening now.
She's listening. Well, you're doing a really great job. My only problem is that I think you have a better voice than I do. You have a fabulous radio voice, and I think people tuning in are going to think you're the host, and I'm the interviewee. You have a marvelous timbre to your voice. Have you always spoken softly and slowly? Is that a natural thing to you, or is that partly from being nervous on the air? I think it's probably natural to you.
I think I've always spoken quietly, but I'm also not a quiet person by nature. When the situation calls for it, I'm quite loud. But I think after, my God, 40 years of listening to people, well, I have turned into a listener and responder rather than someone who wants to initiate events.
Yeah. Well, I think that we find our own styles. I suspect that I'm probably a lot more active than you are in a lot of therapy. Not always. Certainly if I have somebody who's injured or very disturbed, I get real quiet. I think it's so important as a therapist, a helper, a caregiver, that you find your own comfort.
Mm-hmm.
Your own comfort. And you seem very comfortable with how you are with the people you're helping, and I feel the same way. I find that I vary a lot with people.
That's what I find, too.
You find that too.
Yeah,
sure, you start getting in touch with
them.
Well, even interviewing you, I slow down and I'm listening.
Some of my patients would be surprised to hear you describing me as quiet and slow. Because
that's what I'm wondering about. I'm wondering what your style is like when you're in a therapy session. Right today, you have done a fabulous job. Your vignettes, the things you describe, are very pithy and very to the point. And people can hear you. Dick Gottlieb is going to be giving a workshop at our empathic therapy conference. We still have a few places open. It may fill. It may overflow. We have visions of the fire marshal coming in. So we're getting near, but there's still some places, as best as we can tell, some openings. So please, please sign up and come and support what we are doing at the Empathic Therapy Conference, April 8th through 10th, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, in Syracuse, New York. And the way you get every bit of information you need about the conference, like the people who are going to be there, the hotel, how to get the hotel, prices, and what it's like around Syracuse. You can get all that information on empathictherapy.org, empathictherapy.org. And you can get it off my website, too, Breggin.com, B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com. But go to empathictherapy.org, learn about the conference. It's going to be spectacular.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Breggin and his lifelong reform work on www.breggin.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.